I'm Jesse Thorne. This is The Turnaround, the show where I ask interviewers about interviewing. It's a partnership between MaximumFun.org and Columbia Journalism Review. Today on the show, broadcast journalist Ray Suarez. He's had a career over three decades, and he has done everything. For years and years, he was a senior correspondent on the NewsHour on PBS. He hosted NPR's Talk of the Nation. He was the best host of NPR's Talk of the Nation, their great call-in news show in the 90s. Most recently, he had his own show on Al Jazeera America. Ray Suarez is a real newsman. He is smart and fair and warm and insightful no matter what he's doing. And he can stand in the middle of the craziest circus and make everything feel grounded. He believes there is a right and wrong way to talk to people, an ethically right and wrong way to talk to people, even when you're talking to somebody who you might alienate, somebody you might be relying on that you have to ask tough questions to.
All you can do is be fair and straightforward and well-informed and know that the good ones will respect that even if you give them a hard time on one particular day. And the bad ones won't, but they never were going to anyway.
Ray Suarez is a brilliant guy. I mean, he's not just a brilliant host. He's also written some very serious books, one about the history of Latino Americans, one about the role of faith in politics. But just because he has been doing this for decades and he is a really brilliant guy doesn't mean that sometimes even he gets intimidated by the person he's interviewing.
Well, it was gladiatorial when you interviewed Ed Koch. Because he was on guard, very smart, very quick, and devastating in repartee and in debate, and had a sharp mind and a sharp tongue. So I tried not to psych myself out, but certainly, I thought, oh my God, he's going to make me feel stupid. I don't want that to happen.
That's Ray Suarez. Thrilled to have him on The Turnaround. Let's get into it. Ray Suarez, welcome to The Turnaround. Thank you so much for doing this.
Great to be with you, Jesse.
So, Ray, what is the first time that you ever interviewed somebody?
I guess the real first time was for a school project in seventh grade. I had just gotten a tape recorder as a Christmas gift, and we were assigned to interview somebody. So I interviewed my father, who was a barber, about barbering.
That's barbering?
B-A-R-B-E-R-I-N-G. Barbering.
I interviewed him about barbering. It's the worst joke I've ever made in my entire life. In fact, it doesn't even qualify as a joke. Do you remember how did you end up getting a tape recorder for your birthday? Is that what you asked for?
Yes. Yes.
Why?
I was interested in recording things. The sounds of things, music, people talking. I thought it was interesting, and I thought it was something that it would be good for me to know how to do.
How old were you at the time?
What was I then? 12, I guess.
I mean, that is a very weird interest for a 12-year-old.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, but, tape recorders, cassette tape recorders were still pretty new, and it sounded like an exciting thing to be able to record things.
What were you actually recording?
Traffic, my friends, and a lot of music, and recording things off the radio. Recording disc jockeys doing their work. I recorded a lot of different things.
I remember being around that age and being on an airplane, maybe going to visit my grandmother or something, and there was a clock radio in the Sky Mall catalog that had a cassette recorder built into it. And I remember very vividly sitting there doing the math, like on a napkin from my ginger ale, trying to figure out if I could use my birthday money to afford enough blank cassettes and the recorder that I could record an entire season of San Francisco Giants baseball.
Yeah, it was, there were competing formats in tape back then. And one of the big manufacturers came out with something called play tapes. And it was a unit, and you stuck the cassette, the cartridge in the side of the machine, and it played well-recorded music. And my parents got me that, and I said, well, this is very nice, and thank you, but save all the packaging. I want something that records something. This only plays things that are already recorded. It had no mic input. It had no gain. It just was, it played cassettes, cartridges. And that format ended up falling by the wayside because I think people found the ability to record things themselves so much more attractive. So they took it back and got me this other thing, a Panasonic cassette tape recorder.
You have 2 degrees in things that are not journalism. Did you aspire to be a journalist when you were a young person?
Yes. I decided that it might be a good thing for me to be, I would say 13, 14. I thought being a news reporter would be an exciting way to make a living. And I aimed myself toward doing that. But to me, the craft was always a separate thing from the topics. And I was very interested in history and very interested in the social sciences later in my life. And the craft is something you learn by doing, or so I thought. So I didn't need to go to school to learn how to be a reporter. While I was at college, I worked on the college radio station and worked at the college newspaper and worked on being a reporter in those places. And I figured I'd get a degree in an academic discipline and not study journalism.
Did you imagine yourself being a particular kind of reporter, like a person holding a microphone in a trench coat or a guy with a fedora and a press pass in the band, press conference at the mayor's office or whatever?
Yes, very much at the mayor's office. When I was a kid, I thought that being the City Hall reporter at New York City Hall for WCBS News Radio, one of the original all-news radio stations in the United States, would be about the best job that a human being could have. And I thought, if I ever get to be the City Hall reporter for WCBS Radio, I will be in Fat City. I will be the luckiest, happiest guy. And that was what I had in mind.
Again, that is a really weird aspiration for a teenager.
Well, hear me out. It had aspects of things that were very attractive. You got to travel around. You got to carry this thing, a press pass, that made barriers open and made people part like the Red Sea, and you could go in to places that they couldn't go. You met powerful people and talk to them about what they do and how they did it. You got to go places where things were happening and tell other people what was happening. I think if you grow up in a working class neighborhood in a part of Brooklyn that is not full of people, very many people whose names are known by very many people, it can be thought of as a pretty attractive way to go.
Did you feel comfortable right from the start doing the kind of, I guess this is, maybe this is the unkind way of putting it, but the kind of bothering people that's required for that job?
That I had to learn. A lot of the reporting I did as a young guy, figuring out how to do it, involved people who expected to be interviewed. Elected officials, police spokesmen, fire department spokesmen, people involved negotiating for unions during a municipal strike. So they know that that's part of the game. They have a pretty good idea of what they're going to tell you, and you have a pretty good idea of what you're going to ask. And there's something almost formulaic about that. talking to people who don't want to talk to you is a whole different, it's almost so different that it's a different discipline and a different craft altogether.
How's it different?
Well, you have to convince the person on the other end of the transaction that you are operating on good faith, that you are not going to try to trap them or screw them or deal dishonestly with them, and that the whole thing will go better if you just talk to me. It's a kind of, it's an honest con, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, con being short for confidence. I mean, you are entering into a very intimate transaction sometimes. You're walking into somebody's living room. You're walking in the alleyway between two houses and happening on people in their backyards. You're talking to people who are coming out of funeral homes. These are not people who want to talk to you. And you have to present yourself to them, tell them who they are, and then get them to do basically the last thing they want to do in life, which is talk to you.
Can you think of a time that you had to talk someone into talking to you, especially maybe earlier on in your career?
The people who are the survivors or loved ones of criminals or crime victims are very hard people to talk to and have abundant reasons why they wouldn't want to talk to you. But part of the job, the way we conceive the job, is that reporters, especially local reporters, end up talking to a lot of people like that. And first they say no, and, you know, the boss doesn't buy no. You don't go back and say, well, I tried to talk to Mrs. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so, and they just said no. If you bring that answer back to the newsroom often enough, you are not going to have a great career. I can promise you that. So you have to find a way, a set of approaches, a bag of tricks to try to pierce that initial reserve, break through that initial no, and not be jerky about it, because often you're getting ready to talk to people who are at their worst. They can't imagine life being worse than it is right now. And yet you've been given the assignment, the task of talking to them. It's not happy work. I think it does serve some social purpose beyond just being ghoulish or, feeding somebody's interest at the other end of the radio in what went down.
I worked at XM Satellite Radio years ago. I was an unpaid intern, I should say. And I worked on this like youth talk station. This just came up. I was conversing about this with my producer, Kevin. And some crazy thing happened with a teen. And the station that I worked with was like a teens and young adults targeted station.
Mm-hmm.
And the producer, this being XM, they were doing 12 hours of live radio every day with two producers. The producer said to me, she said, well, call them and see if you can get them to come on the air. I can't remember what terrible thing had happened to them, but something terrible had happened to them. And I was like, what do you mean, call them and see if can get them to come on the air? What are you talking about? And they're like, just like call information and look up their name in their town. And I was like, what? And I'm like, but they're a kid. They're not in the phone book. They're a teenager or whatever. They're like, well, just look for their last name and call everybody that has their last name. And I was like, I still remember vividly thinking like, wait, this is journalism bothering people at their house? Count me out.
Well, you know, one time I said to a grieving mother, on tonight's news, if you don't talk to me, all they'll know about your daughter's life is a name and an age and a place and this terrible picture of where this thing happened. If you talk to me, I can tell people a little bit more about her and she'll become a real person with a real life that was lost, and this will make more sense. And it worked. And I think I I played fair with this woman at a terrible time in her life. And I think I also kept my end of the deal and made her daughter more than just a name and a terrible crime and a place and an age.
Do you feel like every time, retrospectively, do you feel confident that every time you were doing this, you were playing fair and being, I don't know, for lack of a better word, being moral?
No, I mean, that would be a lie to tell you that every time I felt that way. I mean, there is something essentially exploitative about doing local news, run-and-gun local news, where you don't really get involved very much in the story. Sometimes you're just checking something off a list, making the needle move, making the assignment desk happy before you move on to something else. So I wish I could tell you that in every case and in every encounter, there was a firm moral center to this. Sometimes it was just making the needle move. It would be dishonest to say otherwise.
Are there particular things that you retrospectively would like to have done differently?
No, I guess I always tried to handle myself according to a certain code. I think if you talk to the camera people and sound people I worked with over the years, they would probably report back that I was decent in my dealings with the people who weren't looking to be interviewed. And I didn't treat them in any way that was fundamentally different from the people who are looking to be interviewed.
Do you ask different kinds of stuff to somebody who is not someone who's used to being interviewed?
Oh, you bet. You bet. Because they don't think of their lives in a way that they are prepared to immediately package it and make it digestible and transmittable right off the top of their head. When you're interviewing, often in a very high-stress situation, someone who's not used to being interviewed, you could really treat them badly and exploit them. You could make them sound stupid. You could make them sound incapable. And I think that would be tremendously unfair. So sometimes you have to start and stop the interview. You have to give them a chance to compose themselves. When they say, wait, can I start again? If you're a jerk, you bear in, tighten up the shot, and just start barking at them. If you're a moral person, and also someone, incidentally, who wants to get a good interview out of the process, you say, no, really, just take a minute. We'll stop, and we'll start again. People who are used to being interviewed and people who have a reason to be interviewed. They're selling a book. They want you to believe what they told the jury. They're running for office. They are very clear about what they want to accomplish in talking to you. People who are suddenly in your ambit and you're getting something out of them, they have to be treated differently, just out of decency.
I would imagine that especially when you're doing television news, part of the challenge of it for an interviewer, for a reporter, is that you only have these few moments of video to tell this story. And so you have to bear in mind as you are talking to someone that goal, that you have to find those couple of moments.
You bet. And sometimes that requires you to ask the same question in slightly different ways, two or three times, until you get a nugget, a concise, coherent, cogent set of ideas that you can use. You'll get the information out of them, but it won't necessarily be in a form that you can use. And that's the difference between doing an interview for a newspaper and doing an interview for television. One is meant to be consumed in a very different way and also recorded, digested in a very different way. A newspaper reporter can take a sentence from over here and a phrase from over there and an impression from over there and turn it into a very serviceable paragraph that does not misstate the reality of what just happened. When you're doing that same job for television, You sometimes have to keep at it until you find a version of the truth that actually suits your very fast-paced method of storytelling that's being imposed on you from on high. I mean, people aren't your producer is on the phone saying, get that two-minute piece down to 1:45, and you can't say, oh, but really, I need the two. You're not going to get it, so you have to do what you're told.
Let's talk for a second about interviewing people who have power. Do you remember the first time that you interviewed someone who was so significant or so powerful that, I don't want to say that necessarily that they intimidated you, but that it, you know, made you take half a step back before you took a full step forward?
Certainly Ed Koch, the former mayor of New York.
Ah, yeah, sure. I can only imagine.
Well, it was gladiatorial when you interviewed Ed Koch because he was on guard, very smart, very quick, and devastating in repartee and in debate and had a sharp mind and a sharp tongue. So I tried not to psych myself out, but certainly, you know, I thought, oh, my God, he's going to make me feel stupid. I don't want that to happen.
Have you ever seen the movie Style Wars?
No, I don't think so.
It's a documentary about, it was made in, I'm going to say 1980, by a guy named Tony Silver. And it was about, it initially was going to be this PBS documentary about graffiti. And it turned into this very amazing, spectacular, maybe the best hip-hop movie ever made, movie about the birth of hip-hop. So it sort of ends up encompassing all the parts of hip-hop in addition to just being about graffiti. But there are these interviews with Ed Koch in it where Ed Koch is describing his various anti-graffiti schemes. And schemes is the only word. Like, they involve attack dogs and perimeter fences. And he's like, so I told them, just get some attack dogs. So they did, you know. And it is both. I mean, on the one hand, with the benefit of, you know, with the benefit of 35 years of time having passed and consideration of things like graffiti as an art form and, you know, modern techniques of controlling urban blight and that kind of thing, it is almost absurd. But on the other hand, he's so brilliant and charming that even I think the most hardened graffiti writer would be like, I don't know, he's a pretty fun guy, Ed Koch.
Well, to interview him, you just had to hope that you were on your game enough that he wouldn't take one of your questions and, you know, diss it to the point where you would melt into the pavement, where and in a totally fair way. If you didn't know what you were talking about, he sniffed you out immediately. So I didn't want that to happen, and I think I did an okay job.
I worked for a minute in the mayor's office of Willie Brown in San Francisco. And he would have these press conferences, and he was sort of a freewheeling, charming guy. But he was so brilliant, like such an intelligent human being. And, you know, there are plenty of arguments to be made against his policies in politics that are very reasonable. But I don't think anyone would disagree with the suggestion that he was like one of the most brilliant, still is, one of the most brilliant political thinkers in California history. And like, I would just think like, how can you possibly do anything other than hope that he charms himself into saying something dumb? You know what I mean? Like, and you happen to be holding the microphone there, you know, like, how do you corner somebody like that? How do you even have the guts to corner somebody like that? Especially when, if you're a reporter, you know you're going to have to be there 2 days later and a week later and a week after that and hope that they talk to you again.
Yeah. Well, the access question is one of the most bedeviling parts of these conversations, because you can't pull your punches and round your corners and hang back because you need to talk to this person next week. All you can do is be fair and straightforward and well-informed and know that the good ones will respect that even if you give them a hard time on one particular day. And the bad ones won't, but they never were going to anyway. I covered Chicago politics for a lot of years and learned over time that they needed you as much as you needed them. Yes, we always worried about whether we would get cut off if we were too tough or unfair or whatever, but you couldn't let that change what you did. As long as you had the goods, you had to push it on home.
How do your own personal political beliefs or convictions shape the way that you talk to a politician or think about talking to a politician or a person in governmental power?
Well, to a very large degree, you have to set that aside because you work for your employer. If there's ever a Ray Suarez channel on some some program offering, I suppose I can bring my own political convictions or my ideas or my pet notions into it. But you really have to set that aside, and in order to keep faith with your audience. They will not believe the things you say if you apparently are pulling on one side of the rope in the great tug of war of ideas. And once I had a problem with a senator here in Washington, and he said, "You were really unfair to me the last time we spoke." And I said, "Senator, I had to ask you those questions. How could I ask you anything else? This idea that I was unfair to you, what would be unfair to you is not making you defend those ideas. You were talking to over a million people. You're there to explain why that your ideas about this situation are good ones. That's not unfair to make you do that."
Do you kind of do you run a check in your head beforehand to like make sure that you're thinking about it in those terms?
No, it's really second nature. I mean, I'm not a cipher. I'm not a cotton ball. I have sincere convictions and passionately held ideas about the world and the way it works. But my job when I'm working is to help my employer give the necessary information to a waiting audience that needs that information to build a coherent view of the world in order to do the work of being a citizen. It's a really important job, and it's not – you often get an eye roll when you hear people say it's not about me when you know that it is about them. Well, I really mean it, Jesse, so you can't roll your eyes. It's not about me.
If I could talk about myself for a second. I just did an interview the other day with a musician who had an album that is about his wife dying. She died of cancer quite young. And I know this guy, like he's, I wouldn't say my friend, but he's a friendly acquaintance. And I told him at the beginning of the interview, I said, "Look, man, I'm going to ask you about this is a big part of this interview is going to be about really serious stuff in your personal life. And I just want to let you know, we're not on the air live, and I'm not here to, I have no interest in getting you. And so if there's something that doesn't feel like a comfortable thing, just tell me and we'll talk about something else." And I felt like in that situation, that felt perfectly appropriate to me anyway, a guy who's never had an actual journalism job or worked in any journalism capacity, including high school or college newspaper. But I wonder, what is the calculus for you in terms of giving your subject some control in a conversation?
It depends on the situation. One of the most difficult interviews I've done in my career was with V.S. Naipaul, a writer I totally admire. I've read everything he's written in the last 30 years. I think he's brilliant and probably not a great guy. And you have to separate the two. I'm sitting with one of my literary heroes, but I can't do an obsequious kind of, "Now tell me again how you got so terrific," kind of interview. It's not the literary version of Access Hollywood.
Well, for one thing, you can't do it because that's my lane, buddy.
And you have to, and because he's not a nice guy, you have to have both your hands up to take the incoming as he derides your questions and makes you feel like a dummy. You're there to serve the audience by creating an expository moment. And if you can do that without being in there a lot yourself, mixing things up, great. Some people need that. They need to be pulled out, yanked out, to their own best advantage. Some people are just there. They're right at the surface, and they'll just, you know, gush on command. You have to size up the situation as you're doing it and know how much you is in there and know how much you is not in there. When I interviewed Doris Lessing, boy, what a tough woman and a tough interview, but brilliant. And clearly didn't want to be interviewed. I don't even know why authors go on book tour and don't want to be interviewed. But there it was. Who knows? Maybe she had a bad day. Maybe she had bad travel. Maybe the escort that was getting her from place to place was pissing her off. I don't know. But when she got into the seat across the desk from me, she was not in any kind of mood to play. And sometimes you just got to roll a lot of extra tape until things achieve a kind of flow where they realize, oh, this guy's not trying to trip me. He's not trying to tie my shoelaces together. He's trying to make me be interesting and talk about my book in an interesting way to all these people that I can't see. Maybe I'll just relax and let him do it. And sometimes you can even feel that moment happening. It practically makes a sound.
Are there things that you write down or commit to memory intentionally before you start interviewing someone?
Yes. I go in with a single page with maybe 10 phrases written on it, which are either quotes from the person, quotes that are germane to the story that I'm trying to tell, or points that I need to hit in the interview to make sure that I've hit all the necessary things. They are not written questions. They're more like mental prompts, so that if you get sidetracked and start talking about things that you didn't necessarily intend, you'll remember that you need this. A little bit of sound on this thing is part of what you set out to do before this interview started. It is a very old habit, and it served me very well.
Can you give me an example from your memory of what kinds of things are in particular were written on a piece of paper for a particular interview?
Well, you know, you imagine an interview has an arc, a place where it starts in order to make sense, a middle passage where you're really doing the work of grinding out the expository factual basis for it, and a way that it ends beyond just saying, "Okay, thank you, goodbye." So there's a hierarchy of ideas written down on the piece of paper, the things I have to get to at the top, the things I want to get to in the middle, and then if there's time, something that I might want to just keep in my hip pocket that might charm the person or surprise them that I know that, or surprise them that I know that in a bad way. If you put that right at the top, then the person is guarded, unwilling to share, unwilling to talk for the rest of the interview. You got to put it at the end, not as a way of sandbagging them, but as just as a strategic question so that you don't have somebody who clams up and is becoming too careful. So if you're interviewing, let's say, the head of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus on immigration, there are certain things that are in today's news, so you'll put a phrase in the top, presidential proposal. And then you'll put, border arrests, because a lot of kids have been showing up and there's a lot of concern about what the government's doing with the kids once they're taken into custody. They're just sort of phrases that remind you of what it is you're setting out to talk about so that in the course of the interview, you don't get distracted.
When have you been the most scared in an interview?
Scared? One of the worst interviews I've ever done was with Tom Waits, who I think is brilliant. And if you catch him in the right mood, is probably charming. But he was not interested in being interviewed by me. And his publicist sent me over to his hotel room. And he first dressed me down for knocking on his hotel room door. And it went downhill from there. I thought, I can't just say, all right, I'm done, and then go back to the paper and not have a story, since I've left an enormous hole for this story. Yet this man really seems quite angry at me, doesn't really want to say anything to me, and seems not to have been told by anybody that he was going to be talking to me. And I walked on eggshells for another half an hour. One-word answers, him making fun of my questions. And it was only years later that I realized that he was only 6 or 7 years older than I was, but seemed like the Ancient Mariner because he was just grizzled and angry and smoking and perhaps inebriated. And I thought, oh, wow, that's got to be the world's oldest 27-year-old man. It was amazing. It was a terrible interview. But I got a good article out of it, and that taught me something. There have been points where I've been interviewing people in high-tension situations, and when it's live to air, it has to go right the first time. There's no room for waste inventory, and there's no room for junk questions. There's no room for putting people at their ease. There's no room for chasing them around the desk, having to ask them the same question two or three times to get an answer. So those situations are very stressful, and they usually involve high-level public officials who don't want to be talking to you, but they know that they have to.
Stick around. We'll be right back with more of my interview with Ray Suarez. But first, I want you to hear about some of the other great shows that MaximumFun.org makes.
Are stacks of unread books taking over your apartment?
Do you constantly miss your train stop because you're caught up in reading?
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
We party hard.
And by party hard, we mean read books.
So join us every Thursday on Reading Glasses, a Maximum Fun podcast about reading and book culture.
Get more out of your reading life.
We'll help you conquer your to-be-read pile.
Get out of that book slump.
And squeeze more reading time into your busy day.
Learn how to read better.
Wow, that was good.
Creativity, comedy, and friendship. All these things and more are waiting for you at Max FunCon East at the maybe haunted Pocono Manor, September 1st through 3rd. We only have a few tickets left, and they're on sale right now, so head on over to MaxFunCon.com to buy your tickets. Don't miss out.
It's The Turnaround. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the veteran broadcast journalist, Ray Suarez. You hosted Talk of the Nation for NPR live 2 hours a day 5 days a week for, what, 7 or 8 years, something like that.
Yep, 6.5 years.
Well, first of all, I mean, you were fantastically good at it. It's a tough job. One of the things that happens on a show like that is that that is 2 hours, and that 2 hours is probably broken up into at least 4 segments, maybe 7 or 8. And there's no possible way, even getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, that you could really know everything you need to know about all of the things that you're going to be talking about to be as prepared as you would like to be, I'm sure. And so how do you elegantly manage your own relative ignorance when what you know about some particular thing that came up that day, you know, maybe you've got enough background knowledge and prep time to be ready for 5 of the 7 things the way you would like to be. And then there's 2 of the things where you're like 70% as ready as you'd like to be. How do you elegantly manage your own ignorance when you're live on the radio?
Well, you know, some interviewers like to make a virtue out of asking the gee whiz thumbsucker question.
Are we talking about Larry King here?
and they think it's much to their credit that they're willing to ask it. Those are the ones that you fall back on, the, okay, let's start at the beginning kinds of questions. Because it's true, you can't know everything you need to know about everything. You can take a whack at it, and I certainly did, and I tried to be really very well prepared for everything I did. But you couldn't always be, and certainly when we were doing breaking news in the middle of the day, you had to get good at asking the, okay, I'm just getting started at this, tell me what I need to know kind of question.
That sounds like, and it would be, honestly, Ray, from knowing you a little bit and having heard you on the radio, seen you on the NewsHour and on Al Jazeera America, I feel like one of the hardest things for you would be that kind of, like, I don't know what I'm talking about question.
All right. You found me out, Jesse. But yes, I don't like that. They're not my natural wheelhouse.
Because you've said like four, like you've explained like four, you've mentioned like 4 times a concern that, and this is a very reasonable concern, Ray. I'm not pointing this out to make you look bad. But the concern that you've mentioned the most times thus far has been the guest making you look dumb.
Well, because you've asked me about interviews where I was nervous or scared or stuff like that. So I guess it's come up a lot.
Oh, totally. And as I said, really reasonable. But like, for example, when I talked to Larry King, speaking of Larry King, like Larry King seems to be completely free of concern that he would look dumb and is willing to ask the dumbest question that comes into his head in a very sincere way that works very well for him.
Yes.
So
it's a style choice, I guess.
But sometimes,
well,
sometimes circumstances dictate that, you know, I think I'm harping on this because I have the exact same challenge myself, like engaging with the part of myself that's like, that is, egolessly dumb or ignorant. And kind of getting what I can out of that. You know what I mean?
Well, look, I mean, I've always thought that the job would be a lot easier if the assignment was to just be genial, curious, and go in and wing it every day. I've never thought that I have permission or the privilege to do that, because I think that the audience comes to the various programs that I've worked on wanting to know more than they already know. They don't come to watch the interviewer do his thing and find out things that he doesn't know about. I guess it may just be the peculiar mix of jobs I've had. It may just be my own stubbornness. But I've never felt that I have the permission to just go into a studio and say, "Tell me about yourself. Where were you born?" Even when it's called for, it's not the easiest fit for me. I know how to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, well, for one thing, I think that in your case, your jobs have often required that you talk to people in situations where the stakes are notably high and they may have an interest in misrepresenting themselves in a way that requires you to be prepared with knowledge so that you can recognize that as it happens. I mean, when you're talking
Bingo.
To a public figure, a legislator or whatever, they're both practiced and have an incentive to represent themselves in a particular way that you might not be able to recognize if you weren't prepared.
Yeah, that's really a lot of it right there. And you're the proxy for the audience. You're their representative on the scene. So you can't go in there half-cocked. You really need to know your stuff. I've always felt the responsibility to know my stuff. And it's because I feel very keenly the responsibility of any reporter to be the audience's advocate.
It's funny, like I have listened to my friend Mark Maron do interviews and been on his show before, and he'll be on this show. And you know, Mark knows a lot about a lot of things, and he's a very smart guy. I don't think he frequently does preparation for his show. I haven't talked to him about it that specifically, and we'll see what he says when he comes on the show. But I don't think he specifically prepares for things. And I feel like in listening to him do things, it made me feel more courageous to ask questions that, even if they were weird or dumb, I was sincerely curious about, and that I didn't know what the answer would be, because my inclination is to want to know what they're going to say when I ask them something so that I know nothing will go wrong.
No, that's and that is a very defensible style approach to doing what we do. Already having an idea about what the person's going to say because you've prepped. So you have a trajectory in your mind for the conversation.
But having the courage to not do that sometimes has helped me a lot. I mean, I'm not interviewing the president. That, you know, although I would like to, although Mark did get to interview the president.
Yeah.
God damn it.
Well, context matters in those kinds of things. When I have been working with artists and talking about what they do and how they do it, I certainly feel freer to ask those kinds of questions and the things that have just occurred to me when listening to their music or reading their words or watching them perform. There is a little bit more willingness to step out. The audience is more likely to see me smile or hear me laugh. It's a good safety valve for someone who interviews people.
Do you ever smile and laugh when you're interviewing a senator?
Rarely. Unless they lie so unconvincingly that I can't stifle the smile and have to then move on into my devastating follow-up question while smiling. No, it's rare that a senator says anything that's funny enough to elicit a laugh.
Have you ever laughed in the face of a powerful interviewee?
Yeah. There have been times where I've said, I can't believe you just said that. And usually that makes them, that rocks them back on their heels a little bit, and they reconsider a, you know, a blatant, naked, pathetic falsehood. And then they come back and restate for the record.
Are you thinking of a time that that actually happened?
I have said to people, are you sure you want to say that? I can't believe you just said that. Oh, excuse me. I think you just said, and I repeat back to them what they just said. There are all kinds of ways of showing them where the boundary is and signaling to them that they just crossed it.
I know that as a veteran professional journalist, you're never at a loss for words and you never like space out or anything. But if it were to happen to you that you accidentally spaced out while you were talking to someone, or you were at a loss for words when you were talking to someone, is there something that you ask people when you don't know what else to ask?
Well, it depends. If it's live, that's one prescription. If it's for tape, one of the dignified ways to end it is to just say, is there anything that you wanted to tell me about that I haven't asked you? Which you would never take the time to do on a live interview, which are usually very controlled and very time limited. But often, when you no longer can think of anything to say, that brings out the most unexpected answer of the whole encounter. Once when I was interviewing Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago, who was about to romp home to a devastating victory that just laid waste to the field. You know, he's going to win by 25 points or something. And it was the last night of the campaign. And really, I had asked him everything. He hadn't said much of anything. And earlier that day, I had watched him at some social event where he must have shaken about 500 hands. So I said to him, Mayor, before I go, let me ask you something. Does your hand hurt at the end of a day? When you're in campaign mode, and, you know, I've been following you through much of the day and following some of your opponents, I've seen you shake, you know, 500, 1,000 people's hands today. Does your hand ever throb at the end of a day? And his face changed. The muscles in his face relaxed. He said, you know, no one's ever asked me that before. And he explained and he showed me on camera how you shake someone's hand so that they don't squeeze your hand and you don't end up with this, you know, misshapen appendage at the end of the day. There actually is kind of an art to it. But he was suddenly almost in a reverie, taken to some other place. There we were talking about policy in the campaign and campaign spending and, you know, what he's going to do in the next term. And then he very playfully says, here, give me your hand. And he shows me how to do it. Will it reshape the annals of television news? Will it be shown in classes as a technique for taking your interviewer out of the zone? No. But it was a very human, congenial moment with a guy who can sometimes be a little hard to know. And it was fun.
That kind of thing is a really – I find it very difficult to allow my genuine curiosities to bubble to the surface. And I try – like I've spent a lot of energy trying to develop that muscle of – thinking about something that I kind of just want to know what it is like, and then having the courage, because I'm doing the interview, I get to choose what I ask. Just saying it and finding out and seeing what happens, It's kind of a hard thing to do.
Well, I think it's a flow question. You know, we're under such pressure now. The business has sped up. The number of products and masters you're expected to produce for has increased. The time windows for getting your work done have narrowed. So the idea that you might just follow serendipity, ask the kind of question that puts somebody at their ease or they get a kick out of or takes you in an unexpected direction, now feels like a luxury in a way that maybe at another time it didn't. Once the head of the city council, the dark eminence of the South Side, Edward Vrdoljak, he was one of the big powers in local Chicago politics, and he was running against Jane Byrne in an election, and she always mispronounced his name. So at the end of an interview, again, a serious interview about policy and the campaign and the city, I said to him, "Do you ever notice that Jane Byrne can't say your name or at least doesn't want to say it correctly? What do you think is up with that?" And he said, and because he was a quick guy, "Mr. Suarez, if I could figure that out, I'd know a lot more than I do." Bingo. That was the end of the story. Boom, boom, boom.
I think sometimes about, and we haven't managed to book him on the show, working on it. I think sometimes of Nardwar, the human serviette. I don't know. Do you know about Nardwar?
No, I don't. He's a napkin?
It's like Jello Biafra. It's like an absurd nonsense name.
Okay.
And he's a Canadian guy. He's a really lovely guy. I've met him before. And he wears like a giant tam o'shanter and a crazy outfit. And has a very odd, eccentric self-presentation. And he'll do these video interviews, often with hip-hop figures, actually, but lots of other people. And one of the things he does is he'll just hand them objects as a gift and kind of, you know, like, "What do you think of that?" And he does his research, like he knows about the people, and he'll often hand somebody something that, you know, I was watching him interview E-40, the rapper from Vallejo, and E-40 is one of my faves, and I've often thought it would be great to have E-40 on my show, right? I've never managed to get him to show up, but Nardwar hands him a Kinfunction album, and Kinfunction are from Vallejo, and they're, you know, whatever, 10, 15 years older than 40 is. And it was like such a vivid rush of memory for E-40 that he had been handed this Kinfunction LP. And I think of like just the kind of sincere openness of Nardwar, just like, "What do you think of this?" as a technique that is real and actually astonishingly effective. Because it's surprising every time. And that's a tough thing for me to feel like I could do, to just say, "Well, I don't know. What do you think of this?"
Well, I think go for it. You know, we're so protective of our dignity. If you host a program, you're the great helmsman in the wheel room. Setting a course for a crew that believes that the sun rises and sets over your shoulder. I know that's the case with you, Jesse.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we give away our dignity
right now.
Very reluctantly. I mean, do you want to be Milton Berle? I don't know. do you want to come out, run out on stage in a dress? I don't know. I don't think so. So you, at the other end of the, at the other end of the extreme, are these people who think they are monuments chiseled in stone as much as they're broadcasters. We make a very odd deal with the audience. They want to be informed, they want to be engaged, and they want to be entertained. And those three values rise and fall in different proportions to each other during the course of an interview. And sometimes the person you're talking to has little purpose for being on the program beyond entertaining. And then it's okay to be a different kind of person. In the same way, there are many guests who have no function to be on your program, whatever your program is, except to inform, and you talk to them in a different way. The engagement thing is slightly different. You're going to sink a hook into somebody's ear and pull them along with you. Inform them without even letting them know consciously that they're being informed. That's when you get the lightning in a bottle, when the magic of the encounter, the energy that the encounter has on its own, becomes something wonderful that person that you're talking to couldn't do on their own, and nobody would tune in for you to do on your own. You know, it's the alchemy of you and a guest and a couple of mics and trying to make something that exceeds the value and the joy that comes from the two individuals apart just talking to themselves. There's something I think you're feeling that maybe you have a little bit more leg to show is probably right, but you wouldn't want to do that all the time.
Who's the most important person you ever interviewed?
I guess presidents, ex-presidents, Chief Buthelezi of Zululand, who at the time was a guy who could have scotched the whole deal with finding a glide path to end apartheid. Monarchs, prime ministers. I've spoken to a lot of people over the years who have the quality of life of a lot of other people in their hands.
Is it weird to talk to the president?
Yes, because, actually I spoke to them all as candidates. Because unlike Nardwar, you can't just hand them something and riff on it. It's an almost ritual kind of interview where you meet, you escort them to their seat, you begin by thanking them for talking to you. It's a much more formal kind of encounter. In competitive figure skating, they used to have something called compulsory figures, where along with the other stuff that you do out on the ice, the amazing jumps and leaps and turns, you also had to do for the judges a set of moves on skates that showed that you knew the basic vocabulary of skating. So you had to do a figure eight, you had to carve a perfect circle in the ice. And sometimes when you're talking to people like presidential candidates, party nominees, people running for very high office, it feels a little bit more like compulsory figures than it does like an interview where you can just sort of pull something out that's unexpected and charming and interesting.
Do you feel like you're at the point in your career, having talked to a squadrillion important people and so on and so forth, that you can think of Hillary Clinton or whatever as an actual person?
Yeah. I think after your first couple of thousand interviews and your first couple of decades on the air, you might be able to allow yourself a little slack in the rope that you don't when you're first trying to earn your bones. So I probably have a little more room for maneuver than I did earlier in my career, and that's fun.
Like, I feel like I have gotten to the point where the only people that I feel weird talking to in my job are maybe extraordinarily good-looking people, both men and women. It's just weird because I'm just not used to talking to anyone as good-looking as movie stars are. And they're astonishingly good-looking. So that's like a little bit weird, but I'm fine with it.
And they're almost not real in a way.
It is. It's bizarre. But because I've interviewed so many working artists of various kinds, I am pretty used to, even if it's somebody that I really admire or whatever. I think I mentioned on this show in one interview that I interviewed Ishmael Butler from Diggable Planets, and that was like the second Diggable Planets album was the album that I listened to 1,000 times when I was 14, you know, 10,000 times. And so even him, I was like, yeah, I mean, it's a guy. Even when I interviewed Paul Rubens, who's Pee Wee Herman, my greatest comedy hero,
Was he in character or was he just Paul Rubens?
He was just Paul Rubens. But, I mean, that may even be more challenging.
I think so.
But he's a lovely guy, and it was totally fine. I felt like I was talking to a human being. But I feel like if I was – and I feel like I could go and talk to Dianne Feinstein right now, and she would seem like a person. But the president still doesn't seem like a person to me. The president still seems like an abstract idea.
Well, I think it's in part because 99.999% of the time, you've only seen them as a static photograph in a printed piece of material or moving video on a television screen. The actual physical presence of them themselves is a little discombobulating. They are real people who suddenly are now sitting 3 feet away from you. Yeah, it is. That part of it is very strange.
I mean, I mean, granted, we have a particularly unusual type of president at the moment. But, you know, if it was George W. Bush or something, someone who's a little bit more of a traditional type of president, it seems bonkers. I mean, like one time I went to a campaign rally and I tried to give Bill Clinton a high five. You know, he was going through that like handshaking.
Yeah.
And I tried to give him a high five and he saw my high five. He went to high five me, but he sort of went half a hand higher than my hand and then grasped down and turned it into a handshake.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that is so weird. Bill Clinton is a person. You know what I mean?
And awkward, right, who can have awkward moments and be weird and all that. They're not so contrived as human beings, despite every effort to make them so. Sometimes when I've spoken to these people, you remember that it takes them a few seconds to get out of character. Because they're playing a role. And at first, they're like still like the camera's running. And then they remember, it's almost like they hear themselves and say, oh, yeah, wait, real person moment. And get to talk to you like an actual human being until you're doing business again. And then they assume that persona again. It is a weird and it's an unusual way to be. And the higher you are up the greasy pole, the more you are composing yourself to be that person that you become and then unbecome and then become. It is a strange thing.
Is there anything that I should have asked you or you would have liked to have talked about that I didn't ask you about?
Ooh, well done. No, I think we've covered it all, Jesse.
Ray, thank you so much for taking all this time out of your day to do this weird podcast. I really appreciate it.
Glad to do it. And I know that there's some young guy out there with the 2017 equivalent of my 1970 tape recorder who will actually learn something useful and set his path toward the stars based on our conversation.
Wait, are we headed toward the stars? That's awesome. That's way better than I thought we were. I thought we were just podcasting or whatever. The stars are way better than speaking truth to power.
Yeah, that sounds very, I don't know, too serious.
Thank you, Ray.
Good to talk to you, Jess.
Okay, later, pal. Bye. That's the great Ray Suarez. He's doing some academic stuff. And actually, one of his recent projects, he guest-hosted Bullseye a couple of months ago. Very kind of him to do that. I would say this. If you have a television program or a radio show that needs a host, holler at Ray Suarez. He didn't ask me to say that. I'm just volunteering that. The man is available. It's just that they're teaching young people and other useless stuff. You've been listening to The Turnaround. If you like the show, tell a friend. Subscribe and leave us a review in Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows. You can always visit MaximumFun.org to find this or any of our upcoming shows. The Turnaround is a production of Maximum Fun and the Columbia Journalism Review, CJR. CJR's mission is to encourage excellence in journalism in the service of a free society. Learn more at cjr.org, where you can find edited transcripts of all of our interviews. They also have a great podcast that you should check out called The Kicker. All of our music provided to us by Mobius Van Chalkstraw. You can check out his stuff at chopsmusic.com. The creator of The Turnaround is me, Jesse Thorne. Our producers are Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer at Maximum Fun is Laura Swisher. Our managing director, Bikram Chatterjee. Special thanks to Kyle Pope, Emily Erskine, and Daryl Frost for helping make the show a reality. We'll talk to you next time on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.